Welcome to Peoples and Things, a podcast about human life with technology. I'm your host, Lee Vinsel, an associate professor of science, technology, and society at Virginia Tech. You can reach me with comments and suggestions at leevinsel@gmail.com or on Twitter at STS_news. I would love to hear from you. Welcome to episode 30, the final episode of season one of Peoples and Things. Producer, sound engineer, and good buddy Joe Fort and I will be taking the summer off to retool a bit. But we have a bunch of exciting things lined up for you later this summer. More podcasts with all kinds of great guests, maybe some YouTube videos, and other mysterious developments I will leave up to your imaginations. In many ways, this podcast has been about stories we tell about human life with things and why we should put more confidence in some stories than others. Stories about Silicon Valley have been central to how popular culture has talked about and envisioned technological change in the past several decades. I think as the air goes out of our current technology bubble, we are once again seeing that a wave of stories coming out of Silicon Valley have been little more than hot air. For example, stories about how Uber, Lyft, Grubhub, and other so-called sharing economy companies constituted a technological revolution. Well, frankly, that was a load of bull. These companies don't even know how to make a profit. What we need then in our lives are good stories, better stories. Stories with truth in them. I think this episode, an interview with longtime technology journalist John Markoff, is exciting when it comes to good stories about technology and Silicon Valley for two reasons. First, Markoff has covered Silicon Valley since the early 1980s and reported on business and digital technology for the New York Times for 18 years. He has written on a wide variety of topics over those decades, from the environmental damage of digital industries, to the lives of hackers, to nanotechnology, to the role of Bay Area counterculture in computing, to the ethics of robotics and artificial intelligence. In this interview, John and I first talk about his long career. He was a tech journalist long before that idea even existed. I wanted to hear how he became such a person. And second, I talk with him about his new book, Whole Earth: The Many Lives of Stuart Brand, which is also very much a story of Silicon Valley. We talk about Stuart Brand's life, from being an LSD psychonaut to editor of the Whole Earth catalog, from being a prophet of computing and the internet to a proponent of long-term thinking and maintenance. I also talk to Markoff about what I and many others see as Brand's lack of politics, or what we might even call conservatism. In the end, though I see many valuable things in his works, as I explained in the episode, I am deeply skeptical that Stuart Brand has the ideas we need to move our society forward, including when it comes to important issues like facing up to global climate change. I hope you find my conversation with John Markoff interesting. I had a lot of fun with him, and it was a real honor. Get excited. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk to me today.
It's nice to be here. Good to talk to.
So I do want to talk about Whole Earth, but I kind of want to put it in the context of your longer career. You were what we now call a tech journalist long before that idea ever existed. So how did you come to write about the businesses and technologies of Silicon Valley 40 years ago?
So without going on too long. Let's see. I grew up in Palo Alto, California, which ended up being part of Silicon Valley. I actually played in the Hewlett family household. Bill Hewlett went to school with me. Bill Hewlett Jr. went to school with me all the way through elementary school, junior high school, high school. And I delivered newspapers in Palo Alto to the future homes of both Larry Page and Steve Jobs, which is kind of richly ironic at this point because they probably did more to change the way news is delivered than any two humans on the face of the planet. And then I graduated from high school in 67. I went to the Northwest for college and graduate school, and I came back in 1977, and this thing called Silicon Valley had emerged. And I was, at that point, I was a political activist as a result of the anti-war movement, and I was very interested in military technologies. That's sort of where I began mm-hmm. my career as a reporter. And I was before it was a microelectronics center, the region was an aerospace economy. Lockheed was the dominant employer. And so I began writing about what I later came to call the dark side of technology, right. The use of these technologies for a military economy. And then around 1981, the personal computer industry was emerging, and it was just Ronald Reagan was elected. It was more fun to write about personal computing and microelectronics than it was.
Bombs.
And I got a job. Bombs. Smart bombs, right? I got a job writing for the first weekly for the personal computer industry, which was called InfoWorld. And I was sucked into what John Doerr would later call the largest legal accumulation of wealth in history.
Yeah.
So I watched that.
You were, as you've described, you were a hometown boy, and yet this is happening around you. So, for the last 15 years now, there's been incredible excitement and kind of verve around Silicon Valley firms. In the early 80s, was there similarly kind of, was there a lot of energy around these firms? Was it really exciting in the way that we think of it now?
Yeah, there were different generations. And I'm not sure which generation in the last 15 years we're sort of crossing some boundaries. There was the dot-com era, and now we're into the social media and now AI. So we've moved through. But I was around from the move from the integrated circuit to personal computing. And personal computing, my general sort of sense of this is as microelectronic technologies have evolved, each generation has reached a larger fraction of the population of the world. And we're one more turn of the crank and we're at, everybody in the world has one of these devices. But personal computing was the first time that, we sort of created a consumer electronics industry, and this technology was no longer sort of in military and large corporate settings, but it moved out into the household.
Yeah.
And so, yes, Steve Jobs and Wozniak probably were the archetypes of that sort of interest and the personal computer. InfoWorld was interesting because it originally imagined itself as sort of a Rolling Stone, for a hobbyist culture. And then it quickly sort of moved into becoming a business publication as it tried to become a Business Week for a new set of business users who were using computers.
Yeah. And so, you had done journalism a bit before you ended up at InfoWorld. Was it a big transition moving from kind of like, what the work you were doing to a very specialist magazine that was really focused on this one industry, or was it pretty seamless for you?
Well, that was pretty interesting because InfoWorld, the people who are running InfoWorld were not really professional journalists. And so I walked in, I was also coming out of, I hadn't gone to journalism school. I had spent 5 years working for the alternative press, mm-hmm. and I was writing for something called Pacific News Service. And the funny thing about PNS is they were a news syndicate that was picked up by over 300 papers around the country. And so I had great clips. I had clips from all the major newspapers. When I walked into to InfoWorld, they thought I knew what I was doing because they didn't know what they were doing. And so they hired me because they thought I had professional experience. And we all sort of were making it up as we went along at that point. And it was fun. It was a group of people who were sort of close to the hobbyist personal computing world. It was vibrant. Homebrew was still meeting back then, Homebrew Computer Club, which was where, Apple came from, basically, and probably 20 other mm-hmm. companies.
you know, the last few years have also featured, you know, very public and often kind of ear-piercing criticisms of digital technology companies that some call the techlash. But you are one of these few writers who have been pointing out the kind of darker sides of these industries for a long time. So in 1985, you published a book with a co-author called The High Cost of High Tech. So what was that book about, and what was the high cost of high tech at that time?
Yeah, so that's, first of all, just to put things in context, the day before yesterday, you know, there's now at Stanford, at the Green Library, the main library, they've converted the floor into a set of exhibits mm-hmm. about Silicon Valley and technology. And really, it's a beautiful space that they've created. So I just got my tour of it yesterday with Henry Lowett, who's the archivist. And I was completely freaked out because that book is in a display on the exhibit floor. And it's like I've been stuffed and put in the wall with Lenny.
Your history now, John.
You know, where I'm right. already part of, I've become history, which was very disturbing, actually. But so Lenny and I, you know, that came out of, once again, Lenny was someone who had gone to Stanford. You know, Lenny recently was the mayor of a Silicon Valley city of Mountain View. So that was ironic, too, because Lenny had started as an activist. He was involved in an organization, a small movement research group called the Pacific Center, a Pacific Study Center that I ended up spending time at. And it really came out of that, the politics of the anti-war movement of the 60s and 70s, and which was became very anti-corporate. Mm-hmm. And so we began looking at the corporations that were emerging in Silicon Valley and some of the labor and environmental issues that were emerging. Multinationals, you know, the global supply chain was just emerging. And so they were creating this workforce that was being exported into Southeast Asia. And there were all kinds of labor issues. And then, of course, at that point, they were still manufacturing at scale in the region. And it was an environmental nightmare. And so we were pointing out those kinds of things. And then there were also issues around, believe it or not, there was a point, I mean, this was a real lesson for me, where Lenny and I in the early 80s thought that Silicon Valley couldn't grow anymore because the consequences of growth were readily apparent. And, you know, we thought that Silicon Valley then, a decade old or whatever, had reached some sort of limits. I mean, at that point, you needed two incomes to live in Silicon Valley. And we thought that was remarkable. How could that go on? And so we were early to call. You know, computer networks were not even really on the horizon at that point. That was sort of very early, but the you know, the consequences of this technology were already raising significant questions.
I heard some anecdote, maybe from someone at the Computer History Museum, about Silicon Valley being like one of the densest areas of Superfund sites in America or something like that. You know. Like that in New Jersey. So it's a pretty polluted place from these earlier moments in its history, right?
It was. There were not restrictions. I remember going to a trailer park downwind from a semiconductor factory in Sunnyvale, and a guy showing me he could wave a ketone stick, the sensor in the air and capture stuff. It was floating. Yeah. I mean, you know, it was supposed to be a clean light industry, but in fact, the pollutants were invisible. And, you know, what happened, not for environmental reasons, well, it was partially for environmental reasons, but also for labor cost movements as manufacturing was exported. It became clean that way. And they moved the pollution to Asia, basically.
Sadly true. In 1988, you moved from what you ended up at the San Francisco Examiner to the New York Times. And I just wondered, I mean, you've certainly covered a lot more than tech during your time there at the Times, but more and more that kind of became a central part of your work. So I was just wondering, what was it like kind of covering new industries, not for locals on the West Coast who are involved in the computer industry, but for the, like, you know, this East Coast establishment that's like the nation's newspaper of record? What was that transition like for you?
Yeah, I was at that point working for the San Francisco Examiner, and I was there because I was writing about Silicon Valley, and the Times brought me to New York to be what they called then their national computer writer. So there was one person in Silicon Valley who was not really, I mean, at that point there was still a banking industry in the Bay Area, and so he had Andy Pollack was doing multiple roles. He wasn't just covering technology. And I was in New York as the other computing mm-hmm. writer. The Times had a broader view of technology at that point, and there were people writing about other kinds of technology. These days, yeah. you know, everything's sort of devolved into the internet. But at that point, I was brought back as the national computing writer. And in 1988, from the point of view of the New York Times, that largely meant I was responsible for IBM, and then I could write about other things because IBM was seen as the dominant factor. And it was the dominant yeah. factor still. It was just changing at that point. And, you know, it was striking for me I was in my 40s by that point, but going up to see IBM's manufacturing processes and manufacturing lines in the Hudson Valley where they made mainframe computers. And I was so struck because that I had a very different idea of how you made computers. Yeah. I mean, you know, IBM's big problem of making mainframe computers was extracting heat from these very high speed circuits. Mm. And so you had these basically these plumbing systems that had to use water to move, you know, heat away from the circuits. And that was not the way it worked in Silicon hmm. Valley. It was a very different thing. So I started as writing about the mini computer industry, the mainframe industry, but I was still focused on Silicon Valley because I could tell that was the story. And I was out on the West Coast half a dozen times a mm-hmm. year. And after 4 years, the Times let me come back.
Right on. That's what you wanted to do, huh?
So, well, you know, I was never, I mean, just from, I thought the story yeah. was there, the story I was interested in writing about. And, you know, the Times was very, they let me go with what I was interested about. And, you know, I was writing about things. When I was at the Times in 88, one of the first stories I wrote that had a really big impact was what was called the Morris Worm. Mm-hmm. And it was really the first time, this is November of 88, it was really the first time that computer networks, for both all their positive and negative sort of effects they're going to have, work, really reached a national mm-hmm. audience. That was that kind of a...
I was going to ask you about the two books on hackers that you published in 90s, which I think, I'm pretty sure I checked out from the public university or public library in Joliet, Illinois when I was in high school. And read them because I was very passionate about that topic at the time. So was that, you know, how did you get, was that covering that worm, how you kind of got into that topic? Or yeah, how'd you get into hackers?
Well, no, I had actually, I mean, I was one of a generation that grew up on cyberpunk mm-hmm. science fiction. So I was a science fiction aficionado always going back to high school, but also I was early to see computer networks because I had friends at Xerox mm-hmm. PARC. Where they developed the first computer networks, and they developed programs that had the ability to move through networks. And then I got in the late 70s. My experience with computer networks goes pretty far back because I got my first ARPANET account, and I was interested in being part of ARPANET because I wanted access to a mailing list, listserv called HumanNets, mm-hmm. where technologists were discussing the impact of the technology on society. And I had the opportunity to contact people who are actually building the technologies. And it was really quite, you know, it was a backdoor for me. But at that point, this is the ARPANET preceded the internet. The ARPANET was this military funded network that touched large corporations, universities, and military organizations. And I got access to MIT AI, which was a machine in the East Coast by dialing my little modem into a NASA tip, which was a modem pool that was not password protected. And then I could read that. But then that brought me in contact with this bulletin board culture, mm-hmm. this is before war mm-hmm. games, which is really, you know, the term hacker started out as a positive term, you know, referring to the subculture at MIT of people who were exploring this world of computers and networks. And then ultimately, you know, you got this generation of young boys, mostly who were bored, who were playing around in these networks. And it was before we really realized where this technology was going. I wrote the very first story on a arrest for sort of passing illegal information over bulletin boards in 82 wow. at InfoWorld, where an interagency task force broke into the home literally with a hammer, a sledgehammer, of a deck employee who had a bulletin board system running in his apartment off of El Camino Real in Santa Clara, and took away the computer called 8BBS because it was dedicated to the free sharing of information, much of which would involve credit cards and other illegal things. So that was that world. I saw that world early on, and it was completely a question of life imitating art, because the science fiction writers were the first ones to do this by far. They predicted this dystopian world. Books like Neuromancer and Snow Crash, and most importantly, True Names by Werner Vinge, mm-hmm. really predated the emergence of that culture. Yeah. I ultimately walked away from covering computer security and cybercrime in 2011 after doing it for almost 30 years, and gave the beat to Nicole Perlroth. It turned into the best beat at the New York Times. She was on the front page for the next decade, but it became an affair of the nation state. Right. But at that point, I decided if I had to write another story about a testosterone poisoned teenager with an attitude, I was going to have an aneurysm. I just had to do, I'd written the same story too many times. I had to do something else. And, you know, I gave her the beat.
Well, that's funny, man. In 2005, you published What the Dormouse Said, How the 1960s Counterculture Shaped the Personal Computer Industry. And now there's like a giant literature on this topic. But I feel like, again, you were on this topic pretty early, all things considered. So, I mean, how'd you come to write that book? And I mean, you've already kind of described you were a part of this kind of anti-war counterculture. I mean, this is part of your experience. Was it just like reflecting on where you'd come from and where the industry had come from?
Yeah, it was in a sense. I mean, so I've always believed that technologies are rooted in culture and society, and that they interact and reflect with them. And it was sort of trying to understand, you know, I was gone from this part of the world from 67 to 77. And I came back, and there was this amazing economic and technological region that emerged that was like a Florence. It was changing the world. And so in a sense, it was, I call it an anti-autobiography. It was what happened while I was gone to my hometown. And I really wanted to understand. And, you know, Dormouse, I was trying to understand the interaction between technology and culture and politics. And, you know, while the microprocessor was sort of making its way out of the laboratory, there was a vibrant counterculture, a civil rights movement, and a really intense anti-war movement right in a 10-mile, you know, region. And I wondered how those things interacted. And I think I came to, I mean, you know, I'm a failed sociologist. I dropped out of a graduate program in sociology, and I'm sort of, I try to understand how these things interact. And I actually think I came to the theory that explains this, because, you know, a lot of people basically said that I was sort of making the argument that LSD leads to, you know, creative inventions. And that's not the argument I was trying to make. But I did think there was some relationship between those two things. And some social scientists at the Santa Fe Institute have a theory about, I think they describe it as creativity on the edge of chaos. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what we saw in that situation on the peninsula, where there were three laboratories between 65 and 75, 62 and 75, that surrounded Stanford University, where all of the modern technologies were either invented or refined that became what we know as personal computers and networks today. So why did it happen there and then? And you know, those laboratories were situated in the midst of this world that's very unlike to Silicon Valley of today. It was that, you know, you can't understand how different it was. There was so much going on. It was a different time, and a different the politics, the cultural politics, were entirely different too. So I think that played a role in. And you know, there were so many things. And this is sort of in Northern California during the 1960s, people were looking for ways to augment human intelligence in different ways, from technology to drugs to religion to est. All of these things were swirling and interacting around expanding the human mind, and they played off of each other during that.
So In 2015, you published Machines of Loving Grace, which is actually the first book I read of yours, which covers the history of robotics and AI and both the benefits and costs that could come from them and have come from them. But by 2015 or 2016, you have this long career doing what you've done and as a kind of tech reporter. You start working on a book on Stuart Brand and start hanging out with him and interviewing him. I think you say you spent like 72 different interviews or something like that in the back of the book. So yeah. What led you to turn to Stuart Brand at this point in your career?
So I'd been at Times for 28 years, and I was, I wasn't, I hadn't completely gotten daily journalism out of my system, but the Times really was not interested in me doing something else. They wanted me to keep covering AI. And I had written about AI pretty intensely for a decade, and I was ready to write about something else. And so for whatever reason, almost 70, I walked away from daily journalism. And in part, it was because Kevin Kelly, who was a protege of Stuart Brand's, he was the first editor of Wired, he's a friend of mine, called me up one day and said, hey, Stuart was thinking about writing his autobiography, but he's decided not to, but I think he's interesting enough that somebody should write his biography, and I think it should be you. And I thought about it, and I thought, well, for a couple of reasons, Stuart was the right person and the right vehicle for me. I mean, he was about a decade ahead of me. I followed a path that was sort of behind Brand in many ways. We overlapped in lots of different ways, and so there was stuff around Silicon Valley that he was instrumental in, that I was interested in. The puzzle of why Silicon Valley happened, where it happened, when it happened, was part of, Brand lived there twice while he was in college and then later. He was an interesting character, and I liked the idea of trying something long form and biography that had a narrative arc that I could just follow rather than having to create.
Yeah. That makes sense. As I was thinking about your career the last couple of days, it seems like an extension of lots of stuff you've covered. Computing is in there very much, but also the Dormouse book and, as we'll talk about, Brand was very wrapped up in kind of psychedelic counterculture of that time in California. Yeah. So it seems kind of like an extension of a lot of the themes you've discovered and or played with before.
Yeah. And he touched on both. One of the reasons I wrote in Machines of Loving Grace, or one of the things that I brought out in Machines of Loving Grace, is this dialectic or paradox between artificial intelligence and intelligence augmentation, which has, which I noted first in Dormouse, that there were these two labs in 1962 that started on either side of campus, and one sent out to replace the human. That was John McCarthy, who coined the term artificial intelligence. And the other set out to extend human intelligence. That was Doug Engelbart, who coined the term intelligence augmentation. So you had this dichotomy of AI versus IA. And Stuart ended up being right in the middle of that as well. And it's been a tension that is at the heart of modern computing ever since then. And so I was Brand was part of that.
So I think Brand will always be best known for the Whole Earth catalog. And my parents were kind of back to the Landers and then briefly in the 70s. And I actually have, this is my dad's copy of the next Whole Earth catalog, Access to Tools.
Catalog.
And I actually bring this to class to show students. Sometimes I just go through, I was going through it today and I would just like, I would love to know what kind of fantasies were going through my dad's head when he highlighted, for instance, the book titled Manual for Individual Water Supply. That's highlighted in the book for some reason. It's like, what was my like 21-year-old dad like thinking about at that exact moment,
Oh, that's great. But that's so perfect, because that is what Stuart had in mind when he started out to do this. He was thinking about a generation that was going back to the land, and he realized they needed information and needed tools.
Yeah.
And it was that path that he was trying to create. Where did your dad go back to the land?
They hung out for a while in Durango, Colorado. They're both from Ohio, but they were, they worked at my dad worked at a summer camp there and had visions of remaining there, but eventually went back to East and got a job and stuff, as it tends to happen.
Did he know about drops Drop City, the famous commune in Colorado is called Drop City.
I'm not sure. I'll have to ask him about that. I like asking him about those days, you know. His fantasies have became like some kind of leather making something. I don't know, you know.
That was very much in the air at that time, and Stuart tapped into that and helped in a way spark it.
Yeah.
You know, that's exactly. I mean, that I love the fact that your dad was interested in something that was super practical. Uh-huh,
yes.
And that was what Stuart was trying to do. And you know, that was the, to me, I mean, this is the thing that surprised me about, the thing that I think I learned from one of the journals that was not originally in the collection of his journals that I read, but he gave me later. And that was, you know, most people now think of, there are these arguments that somehow Brand and the Whole Earth Catalog and his view of the world led directly to the modern Silicon Valley view. And what I came to see while I was working on the book is I believe it's exactly the opposite, that Brand is in fact an expression of the forces that were forging Silicon Valley in the 1960s. And that view of the world spread out through that catalog to an entire generation, including people like your father. And it was an early impact of the forces that were creating Silicon
That's
Valley.
An interesting way to put it.
Optimism about technology was prior to digital technology, but you know, tools are valuable things to you know, amplify the things that you want to do in them.
Yeah.
And it was like this instruction manual for inventing your life that tapped into an entire generation. You know, some of them went back to the land like your dad, but other people were like people like Steve Jobs, and it was simply a fantasy amplifier for them.
Fantasy amplifier, I think, is it's like an infrastructure of fantasy or something like that. You know, it's great. Yeah. So how does you know, as we kind of like briefly mentioned, Brand is very involved in psychedelic culture and the kind of what we think of as 60s and 70s. He's hanging out with Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters and all this kind of stuff. So how does that in your understanding, how does his taking part in that kind of culture feed into him becoming editor of the Whole Earth Catalog? Like, how does that transition make sense?
Well, let's see. I mean, the catalog happened. I mean, his inspiration that this would be useful to his friend happened just as he was walking away from the drug culture. He was, you know, the amazing thing about Brand is he was early to many things, and oftentimes he was leaving just when the rest of us showed up, which is absolutely true in my case when you talk about psychedelics. So the path into psychedelics and the role that psychedelics played on the peninsula during the 50s, late 50s and 60s, it's the heart of a lot of stuff that is entangled around these modern technologies, and Brand was in the midst of it. So you have to go back to this very interesting, I think he's one of the most interesting folk characters in American cultural history, a man by the name of Al Hubbard, who grew up in the Seattle area. He had a murky past that was involved in rum running and the OSS smuggling uranium into the United States and running guns into Europe. He invented an anti-gravity device in the 1920s. Oh no, it wasn't an anti-gravity device. It was a free energy device in the 1920s. Just a strange, strange character. He stumbled across LSD in Europe in the 1950s, and he in effect became the Johnny Appleseed of LSD along the West Coast. And he was the person who introduced Aldous Huxley to LSD in Los Angeles, for example. Gerald Hurd to LSD, another interesting writer. In that early pre-psychedelic community. So he comes through the Bay Area and ends up sort of stumbling across this group of people who are sort of I wouldn't call it a religious cult, but it's close to a religious cult. And he introduces them to psychedelics. And a group of mostly technical people, electrical engineers around Stanford, begin experimenting with these psychedelics in the late 50s, early 60s. In 1962, they set up an organization called the International Foundation for Advanced Study in Menlo Park, which is intended to prove that there's a relationship between LSD and creativity. And they offer ultimately between 350 and 500 people on the peninsula. This is now 62 to 66, a very intense experience in LSD. And then you're supposed to sort of engage in your creative design stuff. And they were sort of exploring this. One of the first people to go through this was Stuart. This is actually before he actually came in contact with Kesey. He had, you know, he had played with LSD, with other psychedelics on the East Coast while he was in the military. He comes back, he has this intense LSD experience. He meets Kesey, and you know, throughout the 60s, he becomes a peyote roadman because of his contact with the American Indians. You know, he uses LSD. He's involved in the acid tests, which, you know, Kesey basically was running 63 to 64 to 66. He organizes himself the most sort of the largest and the most sort of ambitious acid test, which is called the Trips Festival, the Longshoremen's Hall in January of 1966. LSD is still a legal drug. And that's an important cultural event because it was the first time, as Tom Wolfe wrote, it was the first time the 10,000 hippies in the Bay Area realized that there were 10,000 hippies, and it had this idea of catalyzing a community. It led directly to the Summer of Love and the Haight-Ashbury and to the San Francisco music scene because Stuart basically brought in Bill Graham to take tickets and help them with marketing. And Graham realized that there was money in music. And the day after the Trips Festival, he went out and leased the Fillmore that became the home base for the San Francisco music scene. And so Stuart would spend about another 2 years, you know, in that psychedelic world. And then in 1969, I mean, of course, Kesey moved away from LSD, and Stuart was there at the acid test graduation. 69 was actually the last time he took LSD, and he was done with it. He moved on. And, you know, at the same time, he was showing Doug Engelbart's system, which was called the online system, to Kesey. And they gave Kesey an hour-long demonstration of this writing tool, basically. And Kesey walked away shaking his head, saying, this is obviously the next thing after LSD. And it turned out that it was. And Stuart then, of course, a couple of years later, wrote this seminal piece in Rolling Stone on Space War. And it was really the first time that people like me, I read that from when I was in Eugene in graduate school. It was really it opened my eyes to the fact that computers were going to be more accessible, and there were these things like computer networks. It was the first hint that we had that. And he framed that as the next step after drugs.
There's computers are part of his vision and become even more part of his vision and his writing in the 80s. We'll get to that. But how does he become so focused on tools, and how does he get into this kind of stuff that we associate with the back of to the land movement, but is much bigger than that, obviously?
Yeah. So, you know, when Stuart was he was living in San Francisco, he was able to attend a series of lectures that Buckminster Fuller gave in San Jose, and was really affected by Fuller's view of the world in that period, 66. So Fuller, of course, is the one. And if you ask Stuart, where does this access to tools idea come from? He'll say he was simply channeling Buckminster Fuller. Fuller's argument was, if you want to change the world, you give someone a tool and teach them how to use this. And I guess this is a notion that must go all the way back to Archimedes, right? Give me a lever and I'll move the world. But Fuller sort of drove it home to Brand. And that was the framing he brought to, you know, he was going to make tools accessible to his friends. Now, but what I realized from finding this lost journal that he kept in the year before he started the catalog, you know, late 67 to 68, is he was also more influenced by Douglas Engelbart than he remembers. And if you think about what Engelbart was doing, he was working on designing computing as the universal tool. That was what was emerging, this digital tool that would you know, transform all media ultimately. And Stuart understood that intuitively. And you know, he captured that. And so it was from those two, you know, Engelbart and Fuller were very influential in that period.
That was something that really stood out to me about your book, and that was new to me, is I, you know, he's kind of famously involved with the Whole Earth Electronic Link, this famous early online community. And, you know, and then he writes his 1987 book, The Media Lab, Inventing the Future at MIT. And I always thought that, saw that as kind of a shift in his focus. But I feel like you're saying it's more, he's already kind of thinking about those issues in this earlier period. So then how do you think about what he's up to in the 80s then? I mean, is it just like an increasing focus or?
Well, so the 80s, I mean, so is it? There is this period in the 70s that we should talk about first. You know, he walks away from the catalog. He sets it down. His life is falling apart. His marriage dissolves, and he gives up on it. And he famously, I mean, I describe this thing in the book where he becomes suicidal because the catalog is just overwhelming him. I mean, he's had issues with depression throughout his life. His marriage is falling apart. He's out in the front yard of the place where he's living. This is 1970, right after he started. He'd already having a lot of trouble. He decided he was ending the catalog 1 year after he started it. And it only lasted for 3 years in the first iteration. He's out in the front yard and he's digging a coffin shaped hole in the front yard a little bit deeper every day. And the woman who's, you know, who rents him the space says, "Stuart, what are you doing?" And Stuart says, "Well, you know, I went to God and I said, you know, what's my next big idea. What's next, God?" And God said, "Sorry, Stuart, that was it." So he's got this very dark view of, and ultimately he restarts the catalog in 1974 as the Coevolution Quarterly. He decides he's going to create this kind of New Yorker of Sausalito, if you will, this interesting magazine where he'll be the mad monk at the center of it. And he'll then do catalogs again. So your dad found one of those catalogs in the mid 1970s that was a part of the restart of the catalog. And so he goes through this period. Now, during this period, in terms of his ideas and what's motivating him, he had fallen under the spell of Gregory Bateson. And so he really went from the engineering, mechanistic systems view of Fuller to this much more organic, biological view of the world that goes back to, I mean, he was a biology student at Stanford. He'd been very influenced by Ehrlich. He'd seen these ideas around coevolution, and he takes that to heart. And that really becomes his frame, the prism through which he views the world through the 70s. The other thing that happens that people don't really realize is, you know, Holder's catalog, he really had a libertarian view of the world, not so much an economic one, but an individualist view of, you know, we'll take care of it ourselves and we'll do our own thing kind of view, very kind of hippie view. But in 1976, 77, he spends time in the first Jerry Brown administration. And he comes out of that with a respect for good government, for the value of government. And so, you know, by the mid-70s, late-70s, he's no longer a libertarian in that sense of the world. He's moved pretty much into whatever kind of liberalism Jerry Brown represents. And that sticks with him. So here we come into the 80s. And, you know, people now give him great credit for the well and think of the well from historical viewpoint as being early. The well was late. The digital culture was already emerging, and it was not geographically centered. I mean, if I had to sort of look for the roots for a digital culture in America, I would point to CompuServe, Source, Prodigy. And most importantly, if you want to look at a digital libertarian culture, it was coming out of Usenet. Which was this distributed network of Unix computer centers all over the world that had this libertarian kind of vibe to it. So that was all happening. The well happened at the same time, you know, 85, which was, you know, there'd been a half a decade of computer networking already going on. But Stuart, you know, he had spent time with the bulletin board systems and with an eyes conferencing system because of a teaching job he had in Southern California. So he knew about that. Larry Brilliant, who was this doctor who had been in India, had started up developed his own system and persuaded Stuart. He wanted Stuart to restart the Whole Earth catalog as an electronic version. Stuart wanted to create a conferencing system, and he created the well. And you know what people don't know, also, is that really 6 years later, so 85 to 91, Stuart decided the well was a failure because he ran smack into all of the virtual community problems that we're now grappling with as a world. He was early to it. He remains a technological optimist, and so he didn't call it out, his own experience. But his own experience led him to walk away from the well and feeling he'd failed to create the kind of convivial community that he wanted to create.
Yeah, I saw that as a theme throughout the book, too. I mean, he had a tendency to create these things that others saw are great. They're getting very involved, and eventually he would kind of walk away from them. You know, he had kind of done this several times throughout his career.
Oh, well, he did it. I mean, that's the standard operating principle of Brand's life, is that he's great at starting things. You know, what do you do? Someone asked him, "Who are you? What are you up to?" He says, "Well, I find things and I found things." And he's very proud of being able to create institutions that persist. And in some cases he has, and he's thinking hard about that with this organization called Along Now, which he's trying to get to the point where it will last longer.
Yeah, I was actually going to turn to the Long Now next. I mean, I think within my community, at least, this is something he's pretty well known for, is the Long Now Foundation, and it's, you know, which is most famous for its like clock of the Long Now, this clock that's supposed to last like 10,000 years. And the foundation itself is meant to shift us from short-term thinking to long-term thinking. So how do you feel like this starts up in the 90s, right? And then the mid-90s? And so how do you see this as kind of like fitting in his overall story, this kind of development?
Yeah, so when Danny Hillis, who's was a supercomputer scientist who created a company called Thinking Machines, began to sort of obsess about the fact that we were thinking increasingly short-term during the 1990s, he sent out a letter to about 30 of his friends, and he took some reporters on walks to pass this idea along to him. I was completely confused by it, which was unfortunate. I think it's an interesting idea. He sent out this email, and Stuart was the only person who wrote back and said, well, you know, if you're doing this clock, you need to create a library. Stuart was thinking then about libraries and continuity and basically the maintenance of society over generations. Mm-hmm. He'd already started to think along. Long-term thinking was on his mind at that point. And so it fit very nicely. It became his overriding passion. I mean, it's, you know, he's been engaged in that since 1995. He spun an organization out of it with his wife, Ryan Phelan, in 2011 called Revive and Restore, which is committed to some of the same principles. And, you know, he's working now. It's, you know, even though he thought he didn't have enough energy for a book, about 3 years ago, he started to work on a book on the importance of maintenance for survival of civilization. And I guess the, you know, if you want to, how do you explain that? The best example they cite for this long-term, the importance of the value of long-term thinking is this anecdote about Oxford University, where they discovered that one of the main buildings in the school, the roof had worn out, and they were trying to figure out where are they going to get the timber they need to replace this. And so they asked the forester and said, oh, you know, sir, I wondered when you were going to ask us. We started growing this forest 600 years ago. So somebody had the foresight to actually plant these trees and keep them for that period of time. And I think that's a very nice framing.
So you brought up his like kind of transition away from libertarianism a couple minutes ago. And also, I think it connects, what I want to ask you also connects to what you called his technological optimism. So you mentioned at least twice in the book that Brand's always been kind of attracted to power, or he's kind of been around power. And this comes like, you know, people he's associated with, universities connected to. We can just kind of keep going down the list. But it's got me thinking about something. In the technology study circles I run in, I think Brand has a very mixed reputation. And a lot of people criticize him for basically being what we might call like apolitical in some sense. And the criticism goes that, you know, he's well known, he has a big megaphone, lots of Twitter followers, for instance, but he doesn't use that for what, you know, certain people would say, like, is their vision of social good. So, like, give a concrete example, he's not publicly criticizing Amazon for its lousy labor practices. He's, like, taking money from Bezos to build the clock, you know, would be, like, a classic example that folks would point to of, like, he's not really going after the power structures that kind of create ill stuff, at least directly and publicly and vocally. So what do you kind of make of that criticism and, you know, the role it plays in his life?
Yeah. So Stuart is someone who, when we spoke first about his politics, he self-identified as conservative. But he's a conservative who can't read the Wall Street Journal because he's so infuriated by their editorial. So what kind of conservative is that? And we went back and forth a lot about what his politics were. I think his politics with respect to sort of activism have also cycled back and forth. I mean, he was active on environmental issues at some point. However, at the same time, when he started the Whole Earth Catalog in the context of a really intense anti-war movement, he decreed that there would be no politics in there. There would be no religion, no politics, no art in the original Whole Earth Catalog. And in fact, he violated his principles constantly in there. I mean, you know, Gary Snyder published his four principles in a Whole Earth supplement. There was a little bit of contradiction in there. He had early on a confrontation where he ended up working with some people who called themselves New Leftists. In fact, although they were actually Maoist, I was part of the New Left, and I was not part of the Maoist or the Marxist part of the New Left. I had a different perspective than Stuart, but he was really traumatized by his early interactions with the what he called the New Left. He was also on basically in Kesey's orbit and what he called the psychedelic side of the anti-war movement, which was sort of anti-political in as much as you can call it that way. And so, he's shied away from activism at times. He's been an activist at other times. He's been a local activist on community issues in Sausalito, for example. Yeah. So it's mixed. And in fact, I find he's closest to Jerry Brown in so many ways. His heart on lots of these issues is on the left. I mean, I think that and his head might be on the right, you know, and so he's torn, I think, is the reason that it gets.
Can you characterize like how you've come to think of as conservatism? I mean, what do you think that means to him when he says I'm conservative?
Well, I think it's strongest. Yeah, it's Andrew Kirk, the environmental historian, talks about this thread, conservative thread within the American environmental movement. I think that sort of is where this goes back to Teddy Roosevelt. That's sort of the
conservationism.
Line that, you have to align through.
Right? Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Very much so. He now does not call himself an environmentalist. He calls himself a conservationist. Right. And he feels that the environmental movement or large strands of the environmental movement that he helped create has actually, got this kind of Luddite framing of simply being anti-technological, where he feels that we're, for better or ill, we're bound to technology. It you can't separate humanity from the use of tools. Yeah. And I think I came around. I mean, I've always been more nuanced on technology than I think Stuart is. I've been willing to criticize technologies, but I can be optimistic about technologies too. So I think there's a bit of a contradiction, but I also see his perspective. And I think you can kind of square the circle. I mean, what I find most refreshing about Brand is his willing to reassess his position. And, he's moved back and he doesn't stay locked in things. He can be moved by evidence. I mean, the stuff on, the stuff on nuclear power is interesting because the environmental movement, I think, is more torn about nuclear power than they were.
Or geoengineering.
In fact, the nature of
geoengineering, which he also advocates for. So this is, I was going to ask you about this, his book, Whole Earth Discipline and Eco-Pragmatist Manifesto, which is very controversial in some environmental circles because he pushes for nuclear power and geo. But go on. I want you to,
So I was just thinking about the nuclear power issue first, because I've found that the framing on nuclear power from the environmental perspective has now changed. The original debate was over waste, and now the criticism, which I think might be value, is that nuclear is too late. It can't help us. It won't come quickly enough. Because of the and so it's a very different framing of the issue. But, Brand, he got... he was mildly anti-nuclear during the 70s and into the 80s. Then Peter Schwartz convinced him that the waste issue was not correctly framed by the environmentalist, and it was necessary to get across the chasm in terms of two sustainable energy sources. And, I'm watching that debate. He opened me up a little bit on it. I was sort of completely anti-nuclear. And now I think, well, if these next generation nuclear technologies work, we need them.
Yeah, I mean, I'm actually, I don't have strong, some of my friends have strong views on nuclear and geo, but I don't, you know. My thing is more the regulatory side of it. You know, I feel like so many of the issues are on climate change and stuff. There's clearly corporate interests that are keeping them the way there is, and the only way you get through that is politics. And that's just like not, that's not how he tends to frame the discussion, you know, is in terms of like the civil rights type stuff, you know, to go back to your earlier story that we would might need to get from here to there, I guess. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I agree. And so I've moved away from my left wing politics, but I was a textbook new leftist, and bumping into Stuart was good for me because, you know, I would see as a result of talking to him, I'd see the world in different ways. And I'd go, whoa, you know, it breaks you out of your paradigm. And that can be very,
you know, I forgot to ask you earlier just to get it, you know, so listeners here, what do you remember the first time you met him? When you were first, like, so when were you, because, like, you guys inhabited, like, similar worlds for a long time. So, like, when was the first time you were on?
Yeah, I have two, I mean, the first time I actually met him was the 1984 Hackers Conference, but there are two earlier collisions with him. One was, we both shared the same event when I was growing up and he was at Stanford. Charles de Gaulle came to Silicon Valley, well, before Silicon Valley, he came to Stanford Industrial Park in 1960 and got this tour. And as he was leaving town, he went down, his motorcade went down Waverly, which went right past my house. And so all the school kids were let out of school. And we were all standing there waving our flags or whatever when de Gaulle came through and, you know, his nose, his cap, it was really quite iconic. And I remember it most clearly because the kids across the street who were a little older, one of them dressed up as Napoleon and lay in the gutter. And then I found in Stuart's journal that he was driving out to do research for his senior thesis on that same day, and the motorcade passed him as well. That was the first almost intersection. And then the even funnier one is when I was sort of a young reporter and went to work for InfoWorld and began my coverage of the personal computer industry. I was in Las Vegas covering a Comdex, and I was invited to the Epson printer party in a hotel on the Strip. And I was, you know, I'd been a starving journalist, and here I was in this opulent environment. And I was standing one evening in front of the largest bowl of cooked shrimp I'd ever seen in my life. And I looked up, and on the other side of the bowl of shrimp was Stuart Brand. And so I said, oh, I get it. Because I knew we both come out of this sort of counterculture, and we were both being dragged into this. And so there was some irony that I saw in that. And that's what was happening is that, you know, as Stuart at that point was starting one of his biggest failures. This is 1982. And he was starting the Whole Earth software catalog, which turned out to be just this terrible idea for a variety. So then I met him. I met him 2 years later at the Hackers Conference.
Cool, man. So have you talked too much about the maintenance book? I write about maintenance too. I have a book about maintenance, and so he actually I founded this group called the Maintainers, and we hold conferences, and he came to Maintainers 3. So I met him in person.
Oh, that's
great. You know, he was a fun guy to chat with, for real. Yeah.
Oh no! What was your book on?
It's called The Innovation Delusion. So the argument of the book is that, you know, our fetishization of the new and shiny often leads us to kind of neglect what we have, what we already have. And I think Stuart likes the second part of the argument. He doesn't like the first part of the argument, which involves beating up on like Silicon Valley and stuff like this. You know, is not his cup of tea.
Yeah. So that's great. Oh, that's interesting. We talked about it in general terms. I drove a stake in the ground. I was trying to figure out how do I end a book about a guy who's still active and thriving in the world. And so I sort of decided to end in 2010, 2011, after the launch of the clock and before Revive and Restore, because my attempt to separate biography from journalism, basically. Still doing it. He was just getting started on the maintenance book when we were finishing.
Right? Yeah. His short chapter that came out as a little like Amazon thing is really fun, and people should check it out. It's like about the World Cup and how they have to like, you know, constantly transform the ships as maintain them as they're going along. So it's what we've seen so far is already good, I think. Yeah. And what's up next for you? Do you have a next project? What are you gonna do?
Well, I have two different directions or three different directions. I'm struggling with them. I'm kind of neurotic about it. I'm thinking about a biography of Engelbart, although I don't know if I'll do it. There is a biography of Engelbart, but it's more of an academic, and there needs to be a journalistic account of. I just don't know if I have the energy to spend a couple more years in the Stanford collection. And then I'm also, this is entirely different. I was part of, before I became a professional journalist, I was part of something that I think of, part of the new left called the Power Structure Research Movement, that's totally lost in history. And there were about a dozen groups around the country that were sort of engaged in speaking truth to power. And sort of that we thought at that point that if we simply exposed these anti-democratic power relations, it would have an impact on policy.
What year was this?
We were naive. So this is from the mid 60s. The 60s, basically. And so there were these groups like the North American Congress on Latin America, National Action Research Against the Military-Industrial Complex, Pacific Northwest Research Center.
I was going to say, it sounds like Nader's Raiders kind of stuff.
Yeah. Very much Nader's stuff. Pacific Study Center. There was a guy by the name of G. William Dumhoff
who wrote Who Rules America.
Who was the Well, so he was a disciple of C. Wright Mills, and Mills sort of is where this started. So between the muckraker, we were the inheritors of the muckrakers and C. Wright Mills' view.
Yeah,
of
power that sounds in cool, America. Man. I would love to know that story.
I thought I would do some oral histories and try to collect that. And I've been talking to people. So that might be that's entirely different, and I don't think there's a book there, but there might be a good essay, about the from the oral history.
Did you say there was a third thing, or those the two kind of things you're chewing on?
Oh, the third thing is I have a slightly open door at the New York Times. I still freelance for them on occasion, and I'm interested in some of the technologies around. That are, you know, material science, quantum computing.
You've written about nanotech for a long time, right? I mean, so that was a thread. Yeah. Cool.
So, I mean, just because fun.
Fascinating stuff, right?
And and some of it's going to have, I mean, you know, fusion power, if it works, is a big deal. Yeah. Quantum computing, if it works, is a big deal.
You could call it if it works.
And I'm... That's actually a good idea. I like that. Yeah, if it works. That is actually kind of steal that from you.
Yeah, sure, you can have it. I can give you some other examples, too, I think. So, yeah.
Yeah. So, we've been around long enough to have a slightly raised eyebrow. But...
Well, John, man, this was so much fun. It was wonderful talking to you about your career. And thanks so much for taking the time today.
Yeah, very good to meet you, and I hope we can stay in touch.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of our podcast. Peoples and Things, like most things in this world, depends on the work of many people. I want to thank my brother Jake Vinsel for writing the music for the show. I want to thank my buddy Juliana Castro for designing the logos for the podcast. You can check out her work at julianacastro.co. Peoples and Things is a production of Virginia Tech Publishing and the University Libraries at Virginia Tech. Production activities are supported by the Athenaeum, a space in the library that acts as a hub for digital humanities teaching, learning, and creation. Joe Fort is the Athenaeum Coordinator and Digital Humanities Specialist at VT Libraries, and he serves as producer and sound engineer for the podcast. For information about other podcasts from Virginia Tech Publishing, visit publishing.vt.edu. I also want to thank you for listening. Thanks.